I guess we were sort of walking around Friday looking for each other, and it just didn't happen. Walked around most of yesterday, early in the day, and it didn't happen. And last night, just before the banquet, it happened just like it was supposed to. And I don't know if there's a message there, but seems to me that's the way life is today. And in a short time, if I need an example of how the program works in our daily living, I guess our meeting and our conversation sort of sums it up. I got the message that we've experienced some common things in that short conversation. And I got the message that we both experienced a common phenomena at a conference. And I also got the message that we both have a common solution today for our problem. See, it doesn't take 10, 20 years to establish a pretty good bond. It only takes a few minutes to share. And with that, I'd like to introduce David M. and let him share our story, his story, with us today. David.
Good morning. My name is David Manchak, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, David.
That's probably the most important thing that I will ever say. Nothing that I say here today will be original. It will all be those things that you have taught me. I'm also a very nervous alcoholic. That never changes. Usually when I'm asked to lead a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I say yes, because I was taught to say yes. My sponsor would probably break my legs if I said no. And I write it down in my little book, and I promptly try to forget that I have to leave that meeting. And as that day rolls around and it gets closer and closer, I glance at it every once in a while, and I begin to realize that it's coming up. And then this weekend, I couldn't forget that it was coming up. I heard all these beautiful speakers get up here, and I kept thinking, oh my God, what am I going to have to say to these people after all of these beautiful, magnificent speakers? And I got up this morning thinking, my God, what an order, I cannot go through with it. And as I got down here and I listened to the speakers this morning, those butterflies began to gather in my stomach, as they always do. And as people began to come up here and read the various readings, those butterflies turned into large black birds. And as he began to announce me, they turned into buzzards, and they just kind of hover around in here. And as I stand before you right now, I can feel my heart pounding in my chest. I can feel my pulse underneath my arms, in my armpits. I can feel it down my legs. I can feel my hands real clammy and cold and sweaty. And I can feel sweat running down my chest and down my arms and down my back. And I'm bow-legged, and I can feel my knees knocking together. Those are signs and symptoms of what I refer to as stark raving terror. That's how I get here. It has never changed. It is always an honor to be asked to lead any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would like to thank, before I forget, the committee for having me here. I'd like to thank Calvin for calling and asking me, because I don't want to forget that later on. I'm asked to give you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today, and I hope to be able to do that today. You see, you've taught me many, many things. You've taught me that it's very, very healthy that I can stand here today and that I can sweat and that I can shake and that I can have these feelings of my knees knocking together, that those are signs and symptoms not only of stark raving terror, but they are signs and symptoms of health. Because you see, there was a day and there was a time and there was a place that due to my use and abuse of alcohol, I was incapable of feeling those kinds of feelings. There was a day and there was a time and there was a place that due to the direct use and abuse of drug alcohol, I found myself in the emergency room of Westmoreland County Hospital in Pennsylvania on May 26, 1981. I can recall arguing with the intake nurse in that emergency room. She kept telling me, "Mr. Mandachak, you're having a heart attack." And I kept telling her, "You're crazy, lady. This is no heart attack. This is alcohol abuse. This is withdrawal. I know all about it. I've been detoxed before." And she kept telling me, "You're having a heart attack." By noon of that day, I was in the intensive care cardiac ward. My heart was 3 times its normal size. My liver was 2x its normal size. The digestive system had shut down, and on the x-rays, it looked like a little rubber band down through the center of my chest. I went into a coma that day, that afternoon. Brain fever set in, and my brain began to burn itself up. I laid in that coma for 14 days. For 14 days, my wife came to the hospital and sat at the foot of the bed and watched her husband, who had become a vegetable, to alcohol, and she prayed. She didn't pray that I get better, and she didn't pray that I die. All she prayed is that the living hell that our family was living in end. She didn't care how. That's where alcohol took me. During that 14 days, they pronounced me dead 2x. I don't know why. God saw fit to breathe life back into this drunk and send him to Alcoholics Anonymous, but for that I am grateful. I'm asked to give you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I hope to do that justice. Born and raised in Pennsylvania mountains, I knew the effects of alcohol on the family very early in my life. My father drank. He drank abusively. When he drank, he got very abusive. I say that for one reason. He became my first great resentment, my first great hatred, and at a very, very young age, I began to function on this thing called hate on the inside, and yet on the outside showed something terribly, terribly different. Because, you see, because I hated that man so terribly much, and I couldn't identify with him, and I didn't want to be around him, and I didn't like him, and I couldn't separate his drink from his behavior. I didn't know anything about an illness. All I knew was that he drank, he got abusive, and I hated him. And as a result of that, I stuck very close to my mother. My mother was a devout little Catholic churchgoer, and so I became a devout little Catholic churchgoer and very desperately tried to be very, very good to everyone all the time, because, you see, I didn't feel good down inside. My mother and I went to 2 different Catholic churches in town. I was an altar boy in 2 different Catholic churches in town. I went to the local Catholic grade school. I went to Mass every day. I went 2x on Sunday and 2x on Saturday. And I tried desperately to be good. During my years of growing up, you see, I did something that I now look back on as very, very self-destructive. You see, I looked inside me, and I saw a scared, inadequate, inferior little kid who always shook in fear. And then I looked out there at you people in the world, and you were the beautiful people of the world. You were the glamorous people of the world. You were the tall guys. You were the guys that grew up and found chests when you woke up. And I was that scared little skinny kid. You were the football players and the basketball players and the partiers. And you were the ones that could drink and drug and do all those things that I was always afraid to do. And then I would compare my insides to your outsides, and I would feel even worse. I would constantly lose that comparison. I never stopped to think that whenever you went outside your homes, you dressed your outsides up. And there was no way that I could dress my insides up. And so I began to run away from life very, very early in my life. And I believe that I ran to that Catholic Church. I believe today that I used and abused the Catholic Church much like I would later use and abuse alcohol. You see, I ran there to feel good about me. I ran there to feel okay. I ran there to feel comforted. I ran there to find some kind of solace. If you notice, I did not say that I ran to a power greater than myself. I ran to a building. I ran to an institution. And I expected that institution to meet my every need. And when it did not, I became very bitter and very indignant toward that institution. At any rate, I ran to that institution and I hid there. I loved what happened to me there, just like I loved what happened when I drank alcohol. You see, I loved to be told, "Isn't he cute? Isn't he a nice little altar boy? Doesn't he look holy?" And all that good garbage. I just ate that stuff up. I mean, I needed that stuff. I needed it desperately. And people would pat me on the head and they'd say, "Little altar boy, pray for me," and they'd give me money and all that good stuff. And I just ate that up. I could hide there. I could feel okay there. I could be all right with me in my solitude in that building. Somewhere in around my junior year of high school, I knew that I was different than everybody else. I mean, I had always felt these feelings of being different. And somewhere in around that junior year of high school, I began to believe maybe, just maybe, these feelings of different, these scared, inadequate, inferior, kind of don't fit feelings, maybe they weren't necessarily bad feelings. Maybe they were just, maybe I was just different, not different bad. In fact, maybe, and my ego would just love to believe that maybe this feeling of different inside me was different, better than everybody else. And I could talk myself into just about anything. And so I began to believe that maybe, just maybe, God had some very, very special plan in store for me. And that plan be that I leave high school and pack myself into two brown paper A&P bags and go to a monastery to become a Catholic priest, which is exactly what I proceeded to do when I graduated from high school at age 18. Now, you see, at age 18, I had made all those promises to my mother all my life that I'd never drink like my old man drank. I'd never smoke like he smoked. I'd never do the things that he does. I'll never make my mother cry like he makes my mother cry. And I had kept all those promises for 18 years. And at 18 years of age, I packed myself into a two brown A&P shopping bag. I gave all of my worldly possessions away. I was real naive. And off to a monastery in Newton, New Jersey, I traced. And it was an incredible, incredible experience that I began to have out in this world. You see, I got to that monastery and I began to look around at those other men who were in that monastery. And there were 10 of them. And I began to look at their outsides. And I began to look at my insides. And their outsides were all together. And they were smart looking. And they were tall looking. And they were basketball players and football players and all those glamorous people. And they were the intellectuals and they were all those things that I wasn't. And I was that scared, inferior, inadequate, silly little kid. And I shook inside when I had to face those men. And along came the priest, and he said, "Gentlemen, if you all chip in for some pizza, I'll bring the beer, and we'll all get together this evening in the recreation room for a party." And I dug deep. I dug deep into my pocket. And I chipped in for that pizza, and I went out and I helped them fetch it, and I brought it to that recreation room, and I sat down and I started chewing a piece of that pizza. And that priest brought that beer in, and he brought 2 6-packs. And with the priests and the seminarians in that room, there were 11 of us all told. And he brought two 6-packs of Carling Black Label tins, and he sat them down on that table. And everybody reached out, and they all grabbed a can of that beer, and they popped the top of it. And for the first time in my life, I was faced with a decision. Do I reach out and do I grab that thing? I knew what it had done to my family. I knew what it did to my father. I knew the tears that it brought in our home. And never once did those things come to my mind. Never once did I hesitate when I reached out and I grabbed that can of beer. And I popped the top of that beer and I began to guzzle my first beer. And I mean guzzle. And I did not like what began to happen to me at that time. You see, I didn't like that bubble that it left in my stomach. I didn't like that bubble that it left in the back of my throat and up in my nose and that itchy feeling. And I didn't like that bloated feeling, and I didn't like that bubble that kept going from my stomach to my throat to my stomach to my throat. I didn't like the idea that I felt like I was going to barf all over these beautiful looking people. I didn't like any of that. I'd chew up some more pizza and swallow it to keep it down there. My eyes were burning. I'm trying to not let them know that this was happening to me. And I hated that stuff. I mean, it was terrible. It even tasted foul. And I didn't like any of it. But somewhere in around the first half of that first beer, I had what I today refer to as my first religious experience. You see, my first religious experience kind of went like this. I began to get this warm glow in the pit of my stomach. And that warm glow began to grow. And it began to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And that knot that I carried around in the center of my chest began to untie for the first time in 18 years. I began to breathe and I could feel my lungs taking in air. I began to look around that room and do that comparison thing. Man, I began to look at your outsides and you didn't look anywhere near as good as you used to look. And I was feeling a damn sight better than I had ever felt in my life. I figured I could walk better, talk better, sing better, dance better. I could do a lot of things better than you folks could. And I began to do all those kind of things that night. For the first time in my life, in 18 years, I knew why my old man drank this shit. It was wonderful. I had found my answer. Not my problem. I had found my answer. I grabbed my first cigarette that night, a Camel non-filter, and I inhaled from the beginning. I was real dumb. And I loved the way the room spun this way, and then it spun that way, and then it went this way, and I just had a riot that night. I did a lot of stupid things that night, and this is where I need to remember vividly that there's a difference between stupidity and insanity. You see, I did a lot of stupid things, like dance through the monastery halls in my underwear, and play quarterback and run touchdowns like they'll never see in that place again. And they would put me to bed four or five, six times, and I'd skitty out around them and go off and do it all over again. Those are stupid things. You see, stupidity is the lack of logical reasoning. And when I introduce alcohol to this alcoholic brain, there is definitely a lack of logical reasoning. And I do stupid things. But anybody who drinks alcohol, that happens too. Not just this alcoholic. Anybody that sedates their brain has a lack of logical reasoning, and they do stupid things. You would teach me that I would also do insane things in my drinking career, and the insanity of my disease that I must remember and keep foremost in my mind is that time and time and time again, I would pick up alcohol, I would introduce it to this brain and to this body, and time and time and time again, I would get in some kind of trouble. I would get in trouble with me. I would get in trouble with you. I would get in trouble with my superiors. I would get in trouble with all kinds of people, places, and things. And yet, time and time and time again, stone cold sober, I would look at drug alcohol, and I would say, it is my answer, not my problem. And I would put it back into this body and expect it to do something different this time than it had ever done before. And yet, I would do that time after time after time after time. In my drinking career, and it always came out the same way. I always ended up in trouble in one way, shape, or form. That's the insanity of my disease. And I believe that I have a physical, mental, spiritual disease. I didn't know that then. I need to remember the stupid things I do, but I also need to remember the insane things that I did in my drinking career. That night, and the old-timers, when I got to this program, the old-timers told me I would remember more and more of my drinking career the longer I stayed sober. And for a long time, I did not recall how that night ended. And it came to me that eventually they did catch me, and they did stick me in bed, and I did pass out that night. And somewhere in the wee hours of the morning, and I don't remember when, I woke up on that cot in that monastery, and I looked up at a tile ceiling very similar to this one, and I remembered the stupid things that I had done, and I remembered those beautiful faces and persons that I had met, all those other fine-looking people, those seminarians, and I remembered how great they looked, and I began to feel that inferiority come back. I began to feel that inadequacy like I've never felt it before. And the guilt and the shame and the remorse for my actions. Because I remembered all those embarrassing things that I had done in front of all those holy-looking people. And my God, those feelings of shame and remorse became overwhelming. And as I mentioned before, usually when I had those kind of feelings, I ran to a church to get rid of them. I ran to a church to hide. I couldn't run to a church. I was living in one. There was no place to run. And there was no place to hide. There was no more alcohol to take these feelings away from me. And I didn't know any other way of living life on life's terms. And as a result, I crawled out of that bed that night. And I went across the hallway to the lavatory. And I did the only other thing that I could possibly think of. And that was to dig through my shaving equipment, take out a razor, and proceed to commit suicide. That became a pattern for me. if I can't drink it away, if I can't run away from it, tell yourself that I'll always get you lots of good sympathy and pity. Two seminarians saw me in that bathroom that night. They took me into my bedroom. They tied me in bed that night. The next morning they came in and they untied me. They began to tell me things that people would tell me for many, many years. David, you don't drink like normal people drink. There's something wrong with you. You should not put drug alcohol in your body. And yet that went in this ear, it went out that ear, and I never, ever entertained that thought in my head. They didn't understand I was different. They didn't understand this was my solution, not my problem. They didn't understand what that thing did to me inside. They just didn't understand. And I would continue to drink. By the end of that school year, I had acquired a taste for alcohol. I didn't care what alcohol. I didn't care how you served it. I preferred your alcohol. It was much more reasonable. I didn't care how you served it. On the rocks, under the rocks, around the rocks, no rocks, the Dixie cup, out of the bottle, with a brown paper bag around it. Didn't matter. It didn't matter whether it was wine, whiskey, top shelf, bottom shelf. I didn't know anything about shelves anyway. All I knew is it did something to me, and it did what I wanted it to do, and I kept drinking as much as I could possibly drink. At the end of that school year, the bishop decided he's going to transfer me to a place in Pittsburgh, and he transplants me to Pittsburgh, and they were real conservative there. They made me run around in one of those long robes with this little piece of plastic that kept splitting my throat, and I'll tell you what, it began a whole new career for me. You know, we had these great big sleeves that we could hide things in, and we had these great big deep pockets, and man, I found out real fast State Store was one block up, and I found out those pockets were terrific for things like prayer books, rosary beads, and pints. And I began to smuggle booze into the monastery, and I began to haul it up to my third floor bedroom, and then I took up carpentry. I found out you could turn two screws out of the back of the medicine chest, and you could pull the whole medicine chest right out of the wall. You could drop your bottle down in there between those two beams and with a string around it, and you could pull it up anytime you wanted. You could hide it there so that when the prefect came to search your room, he didn't find no booze. And I began to smuggle it in. I began to lie about it. I began to do anything I could do to continue to drink in the manner in which I wanted to drink. In the next year and a half, I continued to get very spiritually sick. It is very, very important for me to remember one very key thing in my recovery. I have a physical, mental, spiritual disease. I believe that I got spiritually sick first. I believe that that spiritual sickness progressed regardless of where I was living. It didn't matter that I was living in a monastery. It didn't matter that I was surrounded by spiritually oriented people. It didn't matter that I was in chapel 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 times a day. It didn't matter that I had a library of some of the finest theological minds that the human race has ever known at my disposal for tutelage. That did not matter. As I began to drink and continued to drink, I became very self-centered, very egotistic, very self-righteous, very blinded by my self-centered disease called alcoholism. I need to remember that. It didn't matter where I lived. I got spiritually sick anyway. My spiritual sickness took on what the big book talks about, that very self-centered nature. And I began to look at how the rest of that church didn't meet my needs. And I began to focus on all of the negative in that church. And I would love to be able to stand here this morning and to tell you how the Catholic Church is terrible and how it is corrupt and how it has politics playing in it and how there's a bunch of hypocrites in there and how they taught me about a great God who sat on a big throne with a big black book and he opened it up and he put X's and O's in it and he was sending you to hell anyways because you had original sin. And I'd love to be able to tell you all those gore stories. What I need to be able to tell you from this podium is that in my spiritual sickness, that's all I saw. In my spiritual sickness, that was all I was capable of focusing on. And I focused on people, places, and things, and I focused myself right out of that monastery. I can do that in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous today if I am not careful. If I focus on whether you do a fifth step, and why should I? Or you can go to bars and sit around, why can't I? Or you can chase wild women, why can't I? If I focus on everybody else's behavior, I can focus me right back into the gutter that I crawled out of when I came here. I need to remember that. And in my disease, I looked at only the negative in that church, only the human element of that church, and I condemned it radically because it disillusioned me, as though the universe evolved around my belly button and should bow to my every whim. Finally, after a year and a half in that place, I decided Holy Mother, the church, and I were not seeing eye to eye, and she was wrong and I was right, and very self-righteously decided that we needed to part our ways. And I walked away from that monastery, very, very bitter, very angry, very disillusioned. My resentment toward them was to follow me all the way into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I now had my second great resentment, and I could begin to continue that cancer of anger and hate inside of me. I could hate my father, and I could hate the church. And they were two terrific things to keep me functioning on hate. And which is exactly what I did. I moved out of there. I moved on campus to finish up my college degree. And I began to drink my life away. On college campus, I drank daily. I drank every day. I got drunk every day. I got drunk 2, 3, sometimes 4 times a day. I would wake up in the morning. I would roll over. I would pull out the bottom drawer of my nightstand. I would pull out a bottle of Johnny Walker Red. I would bite off 2 or 3 gulps of that stuff. Then I would open my eyes to begin my day. I would drink my lunch at the local pub, which was a block away. I would go there for my dinner and have my liquid diet then. I would go there after my last class in the evening and polish off the night. And anything I couldn't finish up there, I would drag back to the dorm and finish up there. The last year and a half of my college career, the only thing eventful that took place, other than my drunkenness consistently, was that I met the young lady who was to eventually become my wife. That young lady was relatively sane when I met her. I would love to be able to say the same for when we parted. I believe that we have a family disease. I believe that anyone who dares to love a suffering alcoholic and does not have a 12-step spiritual program of recovery will suffer the signs and symptoms of this disease right along with the suffering alcoholic. And my wife certainly was no exception to that. At any rate, I met that young lady in December, around Christmas time. Easter time, she decided to take me home and introduce me to her family, and I went home with her for Easter dinner. I met her family for a grand total of maybe 2.5 hours for Easter dinner. And come May, when I graduated, they threw me a little get-together, a little party, and invited my family over. And I pronounced to everybody that I was moving in with them. You see, I never made friends. I took hostages. It didn't matter that these people, there were 7 of them, mainly adults, living in a 4-room house. I just kind of moved in, took over their house, and stayed. Her father drank in the manner in which I drank. He had a refrigerator full of beer. He had fists lined up on the counter in the kitchen, and I thought this was a marriage made in heaven. I wasn't proposing, mind you, but this was a marriage made in heaven. I not only took that woman hostage, I took her whole family hostage. And the end of the summer rolls around. My future wife goes back to college to finish up her degree. I stayed with her family. I thought this is Becky. September rolls around, and they finally decided it might be nice if I got a job, started to support myself, and got the hell off their couch. And I figured, you know, there's not a whole lot you can do with a degree in philosophy and a degree in theology. A degree in philosophy entitles you to sit on a stump and think. That don't pay much. A degree in theology doesn't entitle you to do much either. Maybe teach religion. And so I decided, since I had this massive resentment toward the Catholic Church anyways, they may as well pay some of the bills, so I'll get a job teaching religion. So I went to the local Catholic high school, and I got a job teaching religion and English at the local Catholic high school, teaching the good little Catholic kids about their good little Catholic God, and for the next 4 years would continue to do that, stoned out of my ever-loving mind. I drank every opportunity I could possibly drink. I did exactly what Dr. Bob does in Dr. Bob's Nightmare. I would find those lovely little white pills that would get me through the professional day, because I knew that I could not go there reeking of booze, and then 9 times out of 10 I did anyways from the night before.
But I needed something to get me through the professional day, and so I played the doctor games, and I had seven doctors and seven family pharmacies, and I was only one person in his family. And I would go to the mall, and I would line up my prescriptions, and I would pop my pills, and I would get through the day. And at 3:07, when that bell would ring, I was the only teacher in the history of the school which would get down three flights of stairs, out the door, across the parking lot, into my car, and out of the driveway before the students could. There was a bar across the street, and I had already set it up with the bartender to have three or four double headers of peppermint schnapps lined up with a beer rinse, and I would shoot those down, rinse it, go back to school so that I could write my name legibly. Because at that point, I could not write at all. That 4 years was to see me try all kinds of control measures on my drinking. I would marry that young lady to control my drinking. I would change from beer to whiskey. I would change from whiskey to wine. I would change the places I drank. I would change the people I drank with. I would change all kinds of crazy-ass things. And always had the same kinds of results. That 4 years was to see me in and out of mental hospitals on a regular basis. And as I stand here before you today, it is not pleasant to think about some of those times. Because, you see, I had woke up in many, many, many places and not known where I was. But those times in the hospitals were the worst. And when I would wake up, and I knew that I wasn't at home simply because of the smell of clean sheets, I knew I wasn't at home. And I would lay there, and I would listen. I would listen for some kind of sound that would give me an idea of where I was. And then I would hear it. I'd hear that little bell ding. And I'd hear that nurse come on unicom. And I'd hear her say, "Dr. So-and-so, report to this and so." And I would know. I would know that I was back in the hospital again. And I would struggle to get up out of that bed. And I would find that I was tied down again. And I would look to see what was holding me down, only to find my wrist strapped to the side of the bed, bandaged again, soaked in blood again. And then I would lean my head back against that plastic-lined pillow, and I would feel those salty tears rise in my eyes and run down my face. And I would say those things like, "Oh, God, it was supposed to be different this time. It wasn't going to come to this then, not this time. I was only going to drink beer this time. How did I end up here again?" And yet time and time and time again, they would sober me up. They would tell me what a nervous person I was. They would send me back out with another prescription, and I would land right back into the same hospital over and over again. That 4 years became four of the most hypocritical years of my life. I could no longer live with myself, and certainly the church could no longer live with me. They decided that they were going to terminate me from my teaching position, and I cannot blame them for that today. You see, they said that they were going to terminate me as a religion instructor because I was not state certified. It doesn't take a brain to figure out you cannot be state certified in religion. There's a division between church and state in this country. State will not certify a religion teacher. They let me go because they could not trust me around their children, and I can't blame them for that today. I was untrustworthy around their children. The next 2.5 years till I hit bottom was to be crazy. I was to do anything and everything to get my money for my drinking. My wife was to stop giving me any money, stop enabling me in that manner. I was to take jobs delivering newspapers in the middle of the night to newspaper boys. I could take a 12-pack with me then. I cleaned out people's basements. I did anything and everything I could possibly do just to get enough money to continue to drink. My wife tried desperately to control my drinking. And usually it was in the form of nagging or arguing or complaining or all kinds of crazy things. And then she would lay those ultimatums down. You know, those times when she looks at you with those looks and says, "You do something or else," and you don't want her to fill in the "or else." And I would say, "Okay, I'll do something." And this time I decided, well, yeah, I'll do something. I'll call AA. You see, I knew about you people. I mean, after all, I had taught a religion class. And I had taught a religion class to seniors in high school, and I had taught them all about the evils and ills of alcohol. And I told them that there was this place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I figured, you know, I'll call you, and you will teach me how to drink appropriately. Or I'll go there, and you'll tell me that I don't need you because I'm so terribly smart. And I called AA one morning, and they asked me if I could stay sober the rest of the day. And I told them, why, certainly I could stay sober the rest of the day. I mean, I just may have this slight drinking problem, that's all. I was very offended by that statement. And she said, you stay sober, and we're going to send someone around to pick you up around 7 o'clock this evening, take you to a meeting. And I said, fine. And I got off the phone, and to give you an idea where the insanity, craziness of my drinking had gotten me to, the mental aspect of my disease, it's 9:30 in the morning. I'm going to start getting ready for an AA meeting at 7:30 that night. Well, that wasn't too terribly far off. It took me about 3 hours to shave without splitting my throat. I was shaking so bad. I was shaking on the inside. I was shaking on the outside. I mean, I was a wreck. And back then, I was real prone to brilliant ideas. You know, these flashes of genius that just kind of come upon you every once in a while. And I had this flash of genius. I figure if I get dressed up in my best three-piece suit, and my best shirt, my best tie, my best shoes, and I go to this AA meeting looking like I don't need you, you'll tell me I don't need you, and then I can come home and tell the old lady I don't need you, and she'll get the hell off my back. And so I proceed to get into my best three-piece suit and wait all day long for this guy to pick me up. You gotta get the picture, folks. This is the same three-piece suit I drank in for 7 years. It hadn't been to the laundry in 7 years. It had burn holes all over it. There was vomit around the cuffs. The knees were worn out, and it wasn't from praying. It was from crawling around filthy ballroom floors in the bathroom trying to find the porcelain throne. I mean, I was a wreck. The tie looked like it had gone through the Salvation Army 5-6 times. They rejected it each time. It reeked of B.O. It had cigarette burn holes all over it. And I'm getting dressed to go to a meeting looking like I don't need you. And this gentleman pulls up in this lovely, great, big, fancy car. It didn't look like any alcoholic car I'd ever seen. His three-piece suit didn't quite look like my three-piece suit. And I sunk down into the front seat of his car, and off to this AA meeting we went. And I'm shaking like a leaf, and they waltzed me in that back door, and there's a great big meeting in Pennsylvania there. And man, I knew the minute I walked through those back doors, I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic. I took one look around that room, and there was nothing but gray hair. I figured there ain't a man in this room a year younger than God himself. I'm too young to be an alcoholic. And I knew it. And they brought me down here, and they sat me in what they called the dummy row, and I was offended by that. And they filled up this cup of coffee, and I didn't like coffee, and they dumped cream in it, and I didn't like cream in my coffee, and they dumped tons of sugar in it, said it'd take the shakes away, and I didn't like sugar in my coffee, and then they filled it right to the brim. And I figured, I got their number. I know what these guys are up to. They can see what a nervous condition I have. They want to see me try to pick up that cup of coffee so that I spill it so they can laugh at me. I'll sit here and die of thirst first. And I sat there and very self-righteously started to die of thirst. And this lady got up, and she's doing her thing at the podium, and 45 minutes later she's still doing her thing at the podium, and I'm dying of the worst case of cotton mouth I've ever had in my life. And I figured, you know, I had learned all kinds of tricks in the bars, and I figured, I know, I'll pull one of my bar tricks. And I knew that in the bar, when I was shaking so bad in those mornings at 7 o'clock when they just opened, and I knew I couldn't pick up my shot, I knew that if I just kind of slid it over here to the edge of the bar and kind of leaned down and slurp the top of it off, you know, so you could pick it up and not spill it all over the place, I knew that I could get enough in my mouth. And I figured, I'm going to do that with this cup of coffee. I'm just going to kind of slide it over here. Styrofoam doesn't slide very well. And my hands went this way, and the coffee went everywhere. And those old fights took out their handkerchiefs and started mopping it up and said, keep coming back, kid. You're in the right place, kid. And all that good garbage, and I cussed them out underneath my breath, and oh, it was terrible. For some reason, and I don't know why, I kept going back. I think it was only because that old dude showed up at my door at 7:30 every night, and I didn't have much of a choice. But for the next 7, 8, 9 days, I kept going back. And I shook. I shook from the inside. I shook on the outside. I was a wreck. I sweat all the time. And I had an experience that I today call the beginner's guide to serenity. You see, the beginner's guide to serenity goes kind of like this. Drink long enough, drink hard enough, drink heavy enough, that you totally saturate absolutely every cell in your body with a cellular craving for alcohol, and then cold turkey it. Your stomach will feel like you have swallowed ground glass. You will drink your soup through a straw if you can keep it down. You will not sleep longer than 10, 15 minutes at a clip. You will change the sheets 5, 6, 7 times a night because they will be soaked in sweat. When you go to the bathroom, you won't know whether you want to sit down or shove your head in there. And that's what went on for 9 days. I shook on the inside, I shook on the outside, I shook everywhere. And on the 9th day, miraculously, in the middle of the afternoon, this calm came over me. It was wonderful. I felt this peace. I felt calm inside. I felt calm outside. I could hold my hand up and see 5 fingers, not 10. It was wonderful. And I figured, aha, that's what those AAs are talking about when they're talking about serenity. My goodness, and I got it in 9 days. Isn't this wonderful? I figured I'm going to go to the beginner's meeting tonight, and I'm going to tell all those newcomers to AA that if they keep coming back like I kept coming back, they'll get this serenity stuff too. And I went to the Monroeville meeting, and I went to the beginner's meeting, and I'm telling all these newcomers that are shaking like leaves that if they keep coming back, and in 9 days, they'll get this serenity stuff just like me. And there was an elderly gentleman in that room, and he looked at me, and he said, David, when the shakes go away that suddenly, I get real scared. I get scared of alcohol withdrawal seizures. I looked at him and said, hell, I ain't felt this good in 10 years. What are you talking about? We got up from that beginner's meeting, and we were on our way out to the regular AA meeting. And I had just spied the gentleman who brought me across the room, and I was on my way to him when I went into a 20-minute grand mal alcohol withdrawal seizure. I remember very little of that AA meeting. I remember waking up on a cold, cold tile floor. I remember feeling that tile floor against my wet back. I remember feeling sweat running all over me, worse than it is right now. I remember feeling my skin as though there were ants crawling all over me. I remember these people standing over me holding spoons in my mouth. I remember feeling my brains inside my skull kind of crackling and sizzling, and they felt like someone had taken them and slapped them on a hot griddle, and they were just sizzling in there, and I couldn't make it stop. They took me out of that meeting in an ambulance. They took me to the East Suburban Hospital, where they kept me for 9 days. While I was there, they tested me, poked me, prodded me, scanned me, and did all kinds of things that they do in hospitals. They told me there's no such thing as an alcohol withdrawal seizure, that I was a terribly nervous person, had a Valium deficiency, that I needed some Valium, Librium, and Dalmane, and they sent me home. I now had my reason not to go to AA, because you see, if going to meetings is going to make me go through convulsions, I'll drink medicinally at once in a while, and I won't go through those things. My wife was so sick, she bought that line. And I began all over again. I began drinking. 6 months later, my wife began to fill in those ultimatums. She said, you do something about yourself, or this time I want a divorce. I said, fine, find me a hospital, I'm ready. And she grabbed the yellow pages, and she flipped through the hospitals, and she found St. Francis Hospital in Pittsburgh. St. Francis Hospital said, bring that guy down. He sounds like a likely character. And they took me up to their detox ward, and they locked me in there, and it's no fancy place. And when they got me in there, they also kept me for 9 days. They also tested me, poked me, prodded me, and scanned me, and did all those things that hospitals do to us. And I'll never forget Dr. Torsky coming into my room. And he didn't tell me that I was a nervous person. He didn't tell me that I had a Valium deficiency. In fact, what he did was he called my mother. and my little sister, who was 13 at the time, and my wife, and had them come to that lousy old stinky, shameful detox ward, and had marched them into my bedroom and sat them down on my bed and sat me on a little plastic chair, poked his bony finger in the middle of my chest, and he said, "Mandacek, I want you to look into the eyes of these women who love you while I tell you what I need to tell you." And he proceeded to tell me that I had what was called an alcoholic cardiomyopathy, an alcoholic heart, that should I choose to pick up any mood mind altering chemical again, I would be dead within 6 months. And some profound things took place. You see, on the outside, out here, in my voice, in my ears, I heard myself say those stupid-ass things that I had said for years. Like, "I'm sorry. I never meant to hurt you. I never wanted it to end up this way. I'll never do that again. I'll never drink again. I never wanted to make you cry." And on the inside, as though my soul had shrunk down into the pit of my stomach, I knew that that AA thing didn't work for me. I knew that I didn't have the insurance for their fancy treatment centers, and I didn't have the money for their fancy treatment centers. Shit, I hadn't worked in 2 years. And I knew when I resigned myself in that chair that day to the fact that I would leave that hospital and I would die of this pauper's disease called alcoholism, because I didn't know how not to drink. I walked out of that hospital November the 11th or 17th or something like that of 1980. By December, I was drinking in my arms, and then I couldn't bend my legs. And my legs and my arms both swelled up to a point, and then my face began to swell. And my feet got to a point that you could put 2 fingers on the top of my foot and they would sink down in the flesh, and you could feel the water flushing around like a waterbed. That's how much fluid I began to retain. By the end of April, I had acquired quite a collection of trash bags, filthy kind of trash bags in what once was a beautiful four-room apartment. I had garbage bags stacked through the living room, stacked through the kitchen, stacked into the bathroom. I didn't need the tub. I hadn't used it in weeks, months. My wife at one time had 2 cats. The cats had kittens. The kittens had kittens. And the kittens had kittens. We had 17 cats in a four-room apartment and no clean litter boxes. That place smelled as fresh as I did. And I need to remember the beginnings of May 8 years ago, because during that month, I would roll off my filthy couch, dressed only in my filthy underwear, and I would use my arms to drag my body on my stomach through that filth to the refrigerator, where I would open that refrigerator door and I would pull out a bottle of 16-ounce Stoney's because it was the cheapest crap I could buy, and I would palm that between my 2 paws and I would cram it up underneath the bottom drawer handle and I would break off the top of it. And I would suck down half of that beer just to find enough strength and courage to crawl back to my filthy couch. And when I would get back there, I would look into the bottom of that bottle and I would curse God and my wife and myself and my church and my family and anything else that was ever held sacred in my life. Because you see, I didn't want to drink. I needed to drink. It was no longer a matter of choice. It was no longer a matter of, "David, would you care for a beer?" It was a matter of, "Get the hell out of my way. I need it." I didn't care if there was glass in it. I didn't care if I had to crawl through cat shit to get it. I just didn't care. I was stuck in an isolation and a hell and a loneliness that I pray to God I never, ever have to go back to ever experience again. A loneliness so incredible. And I believe that hell is the absence of God. And if hell is the absence of God, then truly I knew hell. Because I knew no God. I knew no hope. I felt trapped in a plastic bubble,
screaming out of the world that I could see, and I could watch you function out there, and I couldn't reach out to you, and you couldn't reach into me, and no one could hear me. And I once heard a lead at Punderson, Larry Kay, call it the loneliness of onlyness. And I could relate to that. It gripped what little bit I had left of a soul. That's where alcohol had taken me. Finally, on May 26th, my wife showed up to see if I was dead yet and asked me if I was willing to go to a hospital, and I said yes. That was the morning that they found me in the condition that I described earlier. My heart 3 times its normal size, the liver 2x its normal size, etc., etc. For the next 14 days, I laid in that coma. During that coma, they pronounced me dead 2x. During those experiences of being pronounced dead 2x, I did experience a great white light. A warm, wonderful, beautiful white light. I do not believe that's any great miracle in my life, and I do believe that it was my God teaching me to learn to live life on life's terms, and I also believe it would take you men to explain that experience to me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. At any rate, they told my wife to, while I was in the coma then, my brain was burning itself up, they told my wife to make arrangements for me in a nursing home because my brain was burning itself up. And if I came out of the coma, and it was not likely, I would be a vegetable the rest of my life. There are some people in the program still think I'm a vegetable today, but for some reason, I came out of that coma 14 days later. And for the next 5 days, they found out that I could talk a little bit, I could walk a little bit, I could feed myself, and I could go to the bathroom. That's about all I was capable of doing. They asked me if I was willing to go to a treatment center, and I said, yeah. They said BVR had come up with some money to send me to Gateway Rehabilitation Center. And I said, sure, I would go. I knew I had no other place to go. My wife had made it very clear she was not taking me home ever again. And so I had no place to go. They shipped me off to Gateway. I spent 28 days there. I remember very, very little of it. I remember them giving me this thing called a big book. And I took one look at that, and I thought, oh, wow. And the teacher in me sobered up real fast. And they told me I had to read this big book, and they gave me a notebook, and they gave me a pencil. And I began to analyze that book. I began to analyze all of that book. I went back to them with all kind of notes. I diagrammed sentences from in there. I told them how ill-written it was, how ill-edited it was. I told them that if they gave me half a chance, I'd fix this book for them so it really worked. And they promptly took my big book away from me. They told me things like, my best thinking got me here. And I said, but I've got degrees. And they said, so does the rectal thermometer, and you know what we do with that. They told me that I was a sick cookie. They told me not to drink, go to meetings, and that I was going to have to sit in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that I was going to have to read these big books. But if I was going to make it back, my thinking wasn't going to get me back, that I was going to have to be loved back to life by the big books that walk around in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was about the only way I was ever going to make it back. They also told me that I was sicker than most cookies and that I needed all kinds of extended care and that they were going to ship me off to a halfway home. Well, I didn't know what a halfway home was, but I figured I'm willing. What the heck? Had no other place to go. And they said, we're going to send you to Painesville, Ohio. My first reaction to that was, what the hell is a Painesville? That can't possibly be good. They drive me up to Painesville, Ohio, and they drop me off at this great big gray-looking ugly building. I walked in that building, and I'll tell you what, the carpet was green and dirty-looking. It had these big coffee stains all over the place. The walls were dirty-looking. The ceilings were dirty-looking. The residents were dirty-looking. The staff wasn't terribly far behind the residents. The place was run by a woman. To top it all off, she was black. My God, you people in Ohio sell booze in grocery stores. There's a bar right across the street. How the hell could I ever get sober in a dump like this? My defects of character sobered up first, as you can observe. This is that self-righteous alcoholic who crawled through cat shit to get his booze. I'm complaining about the coffee stains on the carpet, you see. I owe a very, very great debt of thanks to that black lady that ran that house. She let me know that it didn't matter that I was the wrong color. I could get sober anyway. She told me she'd much rather see a sermon than hear one any day, and that I could keep my big mouth shut, not drink, go to meetings, count my blessings, say my prayers, find a sponsor, and work these things called the 12 steps. And that's exactly what began to happen. About 3 or 4 years ago, some of the old-timers finally sat me down and shared with me that word had gone out amongst the old-timers in the Painesville area that there was a wet brain at the men's halfway home, and that if I made it back, it would be due to the grace of God and all the help that they could possibly give me, and they began to do that. They rallied around me, and I learned from them, from these podiums and from those chairs. And they were those men that I feared tremendously when I walked into these rooms. Those old farts that I knew would tell me what I didn't want to hear. And so what I would do is I would go to meetings and I would sit behind them and I would listen over their shoulder while they talked to somebody else until I could find up enough guts to talk to those men. They surrounded me and they began to teach me and they began to teach me basic things. They said find a sponsor and I was able to find one. And he began to march me to meetings, 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 and more meetings. And they began to teach me basic and simple things. They told me that I needed to work these things called the 12 steps. And with step one, I had no difficulty. I had no difficulty at all. I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt in my mind that I had surrendered, that I was burnt, that I had lost the war. I had to. My way did not work. I had no difficulty with that. I knew how unmanageable my life had become. That was very, very real to me. And then they told me I needed to go on to step two, and I had a problem there. You see, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I knew that God was there. I had an intimate relationship with Him at one time. I knew that He could restore me to sanity. I didn't think He would restore me to sanity, not me. After all, He might be able to do that for you, but not me. You see, I was that priest who had taken those beautiful, lovely gifts that He had given me, those lovely talents that He had bestowed upon me, and I had drugged them through the gutter. I had drugged them through the cat shit. Certainly God could never look favorably on me. He might be able to do that for you, but not for me. And they told me, David, you've got to start talking to God. And I said, I have nothing pleasant to say to God. And an old-timer said, say something unpleasant to Him, but talk to Him, fool. And that man took off his watch and he handed it to me. And he said, look, I want you to go back to that halfway house. I want you to take one of those plastic chairs into your bedroom. And I want you to sit that plastic chair in your bedroom. And I want you to sit on the bed with this watch. And I want you to time yourself for 15 minutes every day. I want you to put your concept of God, whatever you conceive Him to be, in that chair. And I want you to bitch at Him for 15 minutes every day. I looked at this guy and thought, he has to be nuts. But I was willing to try just about anything. And I began to do that. And I began to sit that God concept in that chair, and I began to time myself, and I began to complain to Him every day for 15 minutes. And I had to go 15 minutes. I wasn't allowed. If I ran out of complaining, I wasn't allowed to quit. I had to continue talking. That's turned into a very, very beautiful part of my 11th step today, just spending time in prayer and meditation. Because you see, what happened was I ran out of things to complain about. And eventually what happened was it turned into 10 minutes of complaining and 5 minutes of talking to God. And then it turned into 5 minutes of complaining and 10 minutes of talking to God. And then it turned into 15 minutes of talking to God. And you know what? Something strange happens when you talk to God for 15 minutes every day. You begin to develop this thing called a conscience, and I figured I better give that guy his watch back before I hawk it. And that's turned into some very, very beautiful, special time, just sitting and talking to my God. Not a lot of formal prayer, not a lot of wordiness, just my heart to His heart, and His lips to my ears, listening and asking for His will in my life and the courage and the power to carry that out. One day at a time in a program of recovery, that has become very, very special to me and very beautiful to me. I began slowly to take that second and third step. They told me that I needed to have faith in God and that I needed to trust God. And it had been a long time since I trusted anyone or had faith in anyone. And I had difficulty there. And they told me simple things. They told me that I was so complex, I could confuse a one-car funeral, and that I needed to keep it real simple and real basic. And so they told me a lot of stories. They told me the story about the gentleman who goes to Niagara Falls and stretches a tightrope across Niagara Falls. And he jumps up on this tightrope, and he sits a wheelbarrow down on that wire, and he tightropes across Niagara Falls. And whenever he got across there, a great crowd had gathered. And he asked that crowd two questions. He asked them, do you have faith that I can do that again, and do you trust that I can do that again? And he said, the crowd says, yes, we have faith and trust that you can do that again. We saw you do it. And he hops up there, and he puts his little wheelbarrow down, and he wheelbarrows all the way back. And he asked that great crowd the same two questions. Do you have faith that I can do that again? And do you trust that I can do that again? And they said, yeah, we saw you do it twice. Of course we have faith and trust that you can do that again. And he hopped up on the wire, and he put his little wheelbarrow down. And he says, if you have faith that I can do it again, and if you trust that I can do it again, get in the wheelbarrow. And that's exactly what the old-timers told me, get in the wheelbarrow. Get in God's wheelbarrow. It doesn't matter how shaky it gets out there on the wire, just stay in God's wheelbarrow, and He will get you through to the other side. And yes, there will be times of shakiness out there, and pain out there, and fear out there, and all kinds of other things out there. Just stay in God's wheelbarrow, and He will get you through to the other side. That has served me well in my program of recovery. Just get in God's wheelbarrow and stay there. Because sobriety hasn't always been beautiful and roses and peaches and cream. It has had its hard and difficult moments that I've needed to just get in God's wheelbarrow and hold on for a passion. I believe that it is steps 1, 2, and 3 that network me to a power greater than myself, a power that I can then use to begin looking at steps 4 and 5. I, David Mandichak, am not capable of doing a searching and fearless moral inventory. Share it with God and another human being? Are you kidding? I'd much rather take your inventory. It's a lot more fun, a lot less threatening. It's the strength and courage that comes from steps 1, 2, and 3 that enable me to do that fearless moral inventory and to share it with you and to become real with you and to be upfront with you, to let you know that I shit like everybody else shits. That's a power greater than me that I get to do that. To look at those defects of character and list them. To humbly ask God to remove them. I didn't know what humility was. I didn't know what a willingness to let them go was. And again, you told me, and these were steps that demanded my willingness to let them go. To humbly ask God to remove them. And to remember with faith and trust, like the third step, that He would remove them from me. And after all, hadn't He removed the greatest defect of character that I ever had? And that was a compulsion to drink. And that was gone for me by that point. A power greater than myself enables me to work those steps. Not perfectly, just to the best of my ability. No sainthood. To continue to take a list. Make a list of persons I had harmed. Become willing to make amends to them. Are you kidding? I wanted to stand here and tell you about my old man and how he beat the living shit out of us with a razor strap. I did not want to tell you the nature of my wrongs. I didn't want to go make amends to him. I wanted to hold on to my anger and my hate. And you stopped me and you said, wait a minute. I don't care what kind of an old man you had. What kind of a son were you? I am not proud to have to stand here today and to tell you that when I looked at that question and I looked at the answer to it, I had to admit that my father worked that steel mill for years in that freezing cold of those Pennsylvania mountains. He fed me, he clothed me, he housed me, and he doctored me for over 18 years. And all he ever saw come out of this son was hate and disgust and remorse and shame and bitterness. I owe that man amends for my actions, not his. It was my step that I needed to work. It's the strength and courage from a God of my understanding that helps me to do that, to get out of the way to be able to do that, to continue to take an inventory, to promptly admit when I'm wrong. And sometimes I'm better at these than others, to pray and meditate in that 11th step. And that brings me to step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I believe that statement. I believe it to be as true as I am standing here today. As a result of these steps, a spiritual awakening begins to happen, or happens. And I believe it is of the educational variety that we read about in the big book, in the second appendix, in the back of that book, that at some point in my sobriety, in my recovery, I will come to know that I am not the person I used to be. I am here today to tell you I am not the David Mandichak that I was 8 years ago. I have not seen fit to check myself into a nut house in 8 years. I have not seen fit to pick up a mood-mind-altering chemical in 8 years. I have not slit my wrist in 8 years. That's not me. That is something different. I don't react to life on life's terms the way I used to really react. I don't know why that happened. I trust how it happened. I trust that as my feeble attempts at these steps, and I say feeble attempts at those steps, for some reason, a change has come about in me. I am not the person I used to be. For that, I'm grateful. It enables me to live life on life's terms. And although life is a rose, it has thorns. And sobriety has not always been easy. 3 years sober, I watched my home burn down. I watched everything that I had put together in 3 years of recovery go up in flames. I learned a whole new concept of powerlessness that day over people, places, things, and all kinds of other things. And I experienced some incredible things in recovery also. Because you see, that day as I stood on the lawn of the men's halfway home and I watched 4-foot flames leap out of the roof of my home 3 doors away, I watched an army of you men come down Jackson Street in Painesville, Ohio. There must have been 200-300 people show up that day. AAs from all over Lake Geauga and Cuyahoga County. And you put your arms around me, and you said it would be okay and that I didn't need to drink. And I was losing it, and I was crying, and I was a basket case. And you stuffed money in my pockets and said, you're going to need this later. And you brought me toothbrushes, and you brought me underwear. And you said, come on, come to my house. You can stay with us for a while. And you said, there's a telephone, call your family and let them know what's going on. And then you handed me a towel. And you said, here's a towel and here's a washcloth. Go to the bathroom. Wash the tears of self-pity out of your eyes. You're going to Minnesota Sunday tonight and you're going to read the steps. And I looked at you and said, you're nuts. And you dragged me to a meeting and you made me cry all the way through those steps and embarrass myself and all that good stuff. And you hugged me and you held me and you loved me through it again. And you said it would be okay. That I did not have to drink and that it would be okay. And you surrounded me. Clothes came from all over. I had a better wardrobe 3 days after the fire than I ever had. You brought me Jordache jeans, folks. You know, the house burned down on a Sunday, and I had to lead a meeting the following Tuesday, and my sponsor said that when I leave, I should dress appropriately and befitting addressing a group of people who had saved my life. And I didn't have an outfit to wear. And the old-timers took up a collection, and they bought the outfit that I wear today before you. I wear this outfit when I lead and only when I lead. I wear it in honor of the men of Alcoholics Anonymous because you put it on me. When I was naked, you clothed me. When I was hungry, you fed me. When I was homeless, you took me in. You loved me back to life when I couldn't love myself. 2 weeks after that, I got word that my brother in Pennsylvania was dying of myoblastic leukemia. If I wanted to see him alive, I needed to get to Pennsylvania immediately. I didn't have a car that could make it to Pennsylvania. I made one phone call from work to a AA person. In the 20 minutes that it took me to get home, there were 8, 9, 10, 11 of you at my home. You had invaded my privacy. You had gone through my bedroom and packed my underwear. You had packed my little books and my big book and my 24-hour book and the acceptance pamphlets. You had packed a lunch. You had a thermos jug full of coffee there. You had an AA gentleman who had a week's vacation and a car full of gas and was willing to take me to Pennsylvania and sit with me and watch while I watched my brother die of leukemia. That's what you've done for me. You've helped me face life on life's terms. And when I got to Pennsylvania and I sat in that room with my brother for hours on end watching him die, he would fade in and out. And we kept someone in the room because when he would wake up, he'd want some water from all these tubes that were in his throat. His lips would get dry and his throat would get dry. And as I stood over him one day and looked down at him, I remembered. I remembered that 3 years earlier, that time when I was laying in the coma, that time when the family was called in to look at this one because he was dying. And if they wanted to see me alive, they'd better come quickly. And I remembered that beautiful, warm, wonderful white light that I had experienced when they pronounced me dead. And at that second, my brother opened his eyes, and he didn't ask for his water. He looked up at me, and with all the strength he could muster, he said, "David, what are you thinking?" And I couldn't lie. I couldn't even think fast enough to lie to him. I looked at him, and I shared that experience. And he smiled, and his eyes lit up. And he said, "Then it was not a dream." And then he said the words that you people have been saying to me for years. "It will be okay." You see, I believe I had that experience simply to be able to learn to live life on life's terms. And death is the only part of life we have for certain folks. And I needed to learn to face it. I feared death as much as I feared life in my lifetime. I needed to learn to accept my brother's death, to help his family accept his death, his three preschool children, my parents to accept his death, and help him to accept his death. That's all. No great miracle. Just learning to live life on life's terms. That's the gift you've given me. And the benefits from that life have been so incredible. By the time I think it couldn't possibly get any better in sobriety and in recovery, it gets better, and I don't know why. It was like this weekend. From the minute I got here and the first Lord's Prayer was said, my soul shook inside, and it got better and better and better and better. And I walked out of meetings feeling like jello inside, and it was wonderful. And that's what sobriety's been like. Pain, yes. But always knowing that there was a hope of a joy in these rooms as long as I was willing to come back to them. That father that I hated for many, many years, 2.5 years ago, called me on the phone. That man rips phones out. He doesn't make long-distance calls on them. And the only three things he said to me before he shoved that phone to my mother was, "David, I love you. I'm proud of you. And happy birthday." I hadn't heard those words in 35 years. He and my mother saw fit a year ago to get together and help me with a down payment on a home in Painesville, Ohio. They, along with my brother and sister, sat down at my dining room table for Thanksgiving this year. That's what you've given me. That's what you've given me. You gave me back the family I never, ever had. You became for me the family I never wanted and always needed. I don't know why God saw fit to breathe life back into this worthless drunk. And I don't know why he saw fit to send me to you men. And I don't know why you saw fit to teach me to live life on life's terms. But for that I am forever grateful. Forever grateful. I could never carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous long enough, hard enough, heavy enough, or sincere enough to give you back what you have given me. I could never repay the debt I owe in these rooms. You gave me life, living through sobriety. And one of those titles in this pamphlet was, "Look at me now." And in my heart I say, "Mama, if you could see me now." I'm not in a coma today, and I'm not all swollen up, and I'm not all covered with vomit. And I've joined the men in Alcoholics Anonymous. That is powerful for my soul. I thank you. I would like to thank the committee for allowing me to have the privilege of being here with you today. I'd like to thank Calvin especially for calling me, even if my heart did stop when he called. And with that, I will close. Thank you.